Hello, mead friends. Welcome to the Regenerative Mead Podcast. I'm your host, Brando Tice, and today Frank and I sit down to discuss the different types of mead we currently see in the industry. We start off the conversation talking about the four basic categories that mead can be placed in and what categories are most common. We then dive into mixtures of categories, special recipes, and even renaming some categories for them to be more consumer friendly. Now let's get into it.
Hey everyone! Here at Golden Coast Mead, we consider drinking alcohol not only a luxury, but a celebration of life. If you partake in this celebration, we advocate for drinking regenerative mead made from real honey to help shift the $1.5 trillion alcohol industry in a better direction. When you drink our regenerative mead, you are helping to make the earth healthier, more biodiverse, and abundant. Drop monoculture-based booze and drink regenerative mead. Visit our website, www.goldencoastmead.com, to learn more about our regenerative mead business and be a part of the celebration. Cheers.
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 Here we are. What are you drinking now?
Today, I'm drinking Golden Coast Mead Dry, made from our blend of organic wildflower honeys from Brazil. And the aroma on it is, I mean, it's rich. There's a lot going on in this aroma. I could see people calling it melon, but I also pick up this like wild, tart liveliness that's like being in a rainforest. I don't know if anyone's ever walked in a rainforest in South or Central America, but this is what it smells like.
To the tea.
It's like alive. You've spent time in these rainforests. What are you drinking?
I'm drinking the Chala Sweet.
Oh, Chala Sweet. Okay.
But similar. I know what you're talking about. That it's very alive, fresh.
Yeah,
I think is the word I use.
And like you can't pin it down. It hasn't been just reduced down to one flavor profile. It's like there's a lot going on in here.
But it's like it's hopeful to me.
It smells like hopeful. Like yeah, it does. I agree.
Like when you take a walk and you just smell that smell, it's like there's hope in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
It's beautiful.
It is beautiful. And then the first sip on it is rich and like dry, but also flavorful and tart. And then the honey note is coming throughout that whole thing without being overpowering or really sweet at all. But the aroma is so sweet. And like the aromas when the liquid becomes a gas are so sweet that there's a lot of perceived sweetness. But it stops there. When you go to swallow it, there's like no sweetness. So, yeah, I like this meat.
Yeah, I think we did a beautiful job with the fermentation. And I'm stoked for that to get to
market here soon. Yeah, I think we're going to be bottling it this weekend. It should be at the farmer's markets this weekend and online.
Perfect.
Soon, too.
So I have a question for you.
Okay.
What types of meads are these?
What types of meads? Yes, Chala Sweet and Wildflower Dry are both traditionals.
Traditionals. Yeah. Also known as show meads.
Right, right.
And what does that mean?
Right, so we're going to be talking about the different styles of mead today. And there's going to be some jargon. There's going to be some terms that mead nerds understand and no one else does, but we'll break them down into normal English so that the casual mead enjoyer can get comfortable with mead terminology. And it's okay. If you want to just adapt mead terminology to normal human terminology, we are okay with that.
We support that.
Yeah, yeah. So to answer your question, what's in a traditional mead? Basically, it's just honey and water and fermentation. Mm-hmm. So a traditional has no added anything.
Nothing.
Just take the honey, mix it with the water, add whatever you need to ferment it. So vinification ingredients are acceptable. That means nutrients for different yeast, or if you're going to add some tannins and acids, that's okay too. It's still a traditional.
Okay.
And then adding yeast is of course acceptable, and then other fermentation microorganisms is acceptable.
Okay. And if we diverge from traditional meads, what are like the common groups that we can kind of differentiate from traditional meads?
Yeah, so use the jargon terms.
Okay.
There are melomels.
Okay.
There are methuglins.
Okay.
which is like even a hard word for me to pronounce 14 years later. Methylglins. There are braggots. So those are your three major subcategories beyond traditionals. Okay. And then traditionals can break out into show meads, which are like 12%, 14% ABV. Session meads, which are like 8. I think it's technically 10 and below is a session mead.
Okay.
And then there's sack meads, which are stronger. So like above 14% up to like 20%.
Gotcha. Okay.
And melomel means fruit mead. So it's a mead that fruit has been added to at some point.
Gotcha.
Whether that's during, before fermentation starts, during fermentation, after fermentation, just prior to bottling.
And just to clarify within the fruit world too, there are names for specifically apples.
Sizer.
Which is sizer.
And like cider, but with honey makes it a sizer.
Okay. And then with grapes specifically.
Is a piment.
Piment.
Yeah. Which I guess goes back to like ancient Greece and ancient Rome and the god of wine, Bacchus, being the god of mead. And there being these ancient super beverages like Dr. Patrick McGovern talks about, where they just kind of threw whatever they had access to into the fermentation and tried to make it as delicious as possible.
Gotcha.
So honey and grapes would have been readily available in the ancient world, and they would have wanted fermented both of them.
Gotcha. So you feel like those two have a more specific names because there's historical importance to them?
Yeah, apparently sizer was made in Wales a lot, honey and apples. And then piment was made in Greece and Rome, Hellenic world a lot.
That's fair.
Yeah. And metheglin also has an ancient name because like Shakespeare was writing about metheglin, like Merry Wives of Windsor, they mentioned metheglin. And I think Twelfth Night, they mentioned metheglin.
Okay. And methylene is just herbs and spices?
Herbs and spices added to the mead, either during primary or after fermentation, secondary, quote unquote.
Okay. Are there any like subcategories of methylene that with specific herbs or?
That's where we start to get into these like defined recipe styles. Gotcha. So we've got the mead tree here, which is an artistic representation of all this. It was made by an intern back in 2012.
Wow.
Yeah, so this is an old piece here. But he actually just sewed the pieces on with a couple of stitches so that when we figured out how to do the taxonomy of the mead tree, we could like actually group these properly. But you'll see, you know, some of those basic things that we talked about, like piment and sizer out there on the edges, made of apples and then grapes for sizer and piment. But then we've also got Midas, which is apparently an ancient Lithuanian recipe, which has carnation blooms, acorns, poplar, and juniper berries. So like you're throwing acorns into a mead. Is that categorized as an herb, a spice, a grain, a fruit?
That's a good question.
But we're gonna just call that recipe Midas. So there's a few other kind of regional recipes that have become generic, like Tej. Like it's a tradition, it's a methylene made with gesho, which is this plant that grows in Ethiopia, and there's apparently a lot of different recipes in Ethiopia. Like every family has a different Tej recipe basically, and they might throw a lot of other things, but for the most part Tej has to have gesho in it. Whereas Suwa is, we actually learned about this recently, it's not necessarily Suwa, but what was the word?
Siwa?
Siwa?
I think is what it was.
Mayas. Wasn't it Mayas?
Mayas Siwa? Or Mayas?
Mayas Siwa?
Yeah.
That's when it's, Suwa would be like just with the grain. Mm-hmm. But Mayas Siwa would be honey, grain, hybrid.
Yeah.
So there'd be teff and honey and gesho to make Mayas Siwa.
Yeah.
In the Horn of Africa, like Ethiopia and Eritrea. Then there's some more like modern words like cochineal. That's only happened in the last 30 years. What are some other relatively recent ones? Capsicumil. That's like you throw the chili peppers into the mead. and I call it a capsicumel, and then other mead nerds will know what you're talking about. No one else will. Viking's blood. We just have cherries up there, but it's also hibiscus and hops. And apparently that's based on an ancient recipe, and it's popular because of Denksmeod. They're a mead company out of the Netherlands. But it's become, like, people make a Viking's blood recipe using cherry, hibiscus, and hops, but it'll be different ratios and different strengths and different sweetness levels.
That makes sense. Which I think brings us to Braggots.
Oh, yeah.
Braggots is honey and hops, right?
Yeah, it kind of depends on the ratio there, right? Because, like, what's the line between a Braggot, where it's a mead made with beer grains, like malted roasted grains, or is it a honey beer? Which is like a beer made with honey added.
That's fair.
Okay. Yeah. So Mead Institute, we're trying to get this 51% fermentable sugar. It needs to come from honey. That's what makes it a mead. Therefore, if the other fermentable sugars come from a grain, it's a braggot. If it's the other way around, where 51% or more of the sugars come from grain and you add honey, then it's a honey beer.
So what would we want to call a straight 50-50 blend?
Does not compute. Broke the mainframe.
Beer mead.
No.
Mead beer. A mirror.
A mirror. A beamed bead.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, let's not do that. Okay. Let's just avoid that question.
Okay. But yeah, so essentially, a braggot would be 51% honey, 49% less grain. And that's it, right? That's what a clean braggot is, essentially. Yeah. But you can always add more to it.
Yeah.
Okay. And so within these, I don't know, we can call them the big four, the Methlagen, the traditional, the Melomel, and the braggot.
Nice.
Essentially. We've kind of gone a little bit into, like, the different variations you can have. But what do you see within the meat industry currently? Out of those four, like, what are most people making, or what is popular right now?
Okay, so the mead world, as I see it, is pretty focused on Melomels right now. I think that from a American palate perspective, that, like, fruity flavor combo with the sweetness and the alcohol of a Melomel really scratches an itch that a lot of people have.
Okay.
Like, they want to drink something they can dive into, but then also just totally enjoy. Like, there's nothing like in a really big fruity Melomel. There's sweetness, and then there's tartness, acidity from the fruit, and there's fruitiness from the fruit, and there's tannin from the fruit, and there's alcohol. And, like, I've seen people just get really excited about these. The challenge that I have with it is that it distracts from mead. It distracts from mead is made from honey, right? They, like, pick it up and they go, oh, this is a mead, huh? And then they drink it and they're like, but there's berries in it. So mead is like a berry wine? Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, a Melomel is a mead made with berries or other fruit, right? And so I think it gets a little muddled. And I think it doesn't guide towards the ecosystem expression that a traditional can. Which I think there's a fair amount of traditionals being made. Like, Hedren makes traditionals. We make traditionals. Who else is in the lead on the traditional front? Silverhand out in Virginia is doing a good job with their Orange Blossom traditional. Crafted Mead is doing some cool traditionals. Charm City has some good traditionals. So I think, you know, traditionals are being made. I think that the barrier that exists in the mead world that we need to overcome is understanding varietal honey, and that when you ferment varietal honeys into varietal meads, it can really deliver a taste experience that is beautiful. And when you ferment a regional honey that expresses an ecosystem, it can deliver a transportative experience, like, you're drinking a place in the glass. You're drinking 10,000 flower visits in one sip, 200,000 flower visits in one glass, 1,000,000 flower visits in a bottle. Yeah. So you're, like, being transported to this place where this honey and this mead come from.
And with Melomels, that can be there, but generally speaking, the fruit takes a flavor forward approach, and it's the honey's kind of in the background.
It depends on the mead maker. I mean, I've had Melomels where the honey and the fruit dance wonderfully together, and it's hard to say which is in the lead because they're both so complementary and integrated. And then I've had some where it's like, where's the honey in this even? All I get is fruit.
Gotcha.
I would be remiss if I sold the methylgun category short, because they exist too. Like, spiced meads exist out there. Hierophant up in Washington is doing some incredible spiced meads. There are a few other producers. Green River Ambrosia has a chamomile mead that is like divine. It's really good. The Rookery out in Scotland, like a lot of their stuff were methylglens based on historical recipes. And some of them are just phenomenal, like their lavender mead.
So out of the top four, it sounds like Braggots is probably the rarest.
I mean, those even exist too. Rabbit's Foot was making a Braggot under their brewery label.
Okay.
Because it's kind of a gray area, compliance-wise.
Gotcha. Okay.
In that if you're handling grain, you have to have a brewery license, and so technically you're not supposed to make mead. But if there's grain and honey involved, you could call it a beer. But if it's 51% of the fermentable sugars coming from honey and it's therefore a Braggot, like, should you be making it at a brewery? Well, you have to handle the grain at the brewery, so it's the only place you legally can.
Gotcha.
Anyways. So they had a really good one called Diabol, which is like the Celtic word for devil.
Huh.
And it won awards all the time, and it was rich, and it was honey and really roasty malt and just a little bit of hop profile, but quite drinkable.
Well, you probably don't see it as much as the other three because of like the legal loophole almost.
I think so. And I think it's hard to stabilize. You know, it's not common for brewers to use stabilizers. So I think a lot of brewers just avoid making it because it's not stable.
That's interesting. Okay. So when it comes to brewing those four different types, are there different challenges for each one that you would want to talk about? So like, say you're thinking about brewing a melomel. So you're adding some kind of fruit. What are some challenges that are specific to melomels that you feel like are worth talking about?
Yeah, when you're making a melomel, you are kind of making a fruit wine. So if you don't manage your cap, which is what forms after the fruit goes through carbonic maceration, or whatever kind of pressing process that extracts the juice and the color and the tannin from the fruit, you're going to get this chunk of organic matter that forms at the top of your fermentation. And if you're not punching it down or somehow integrating it back into the liquid, the heat from the fermentation is going to collect and then cook that vegetative matter and turn it into like cooked fruit tastes. And then dissolve into your fermentation and then leave you this like stewed fruit in the best cases, and then like dried, cooked, dead fruit, and even rotten fruit in the bad cases. Yeah. So you got to manage your cap if you're making a melomel, which also means managing your temp profile and your nutrient profile, because just because you're adding fruit doesn't mean that you're going to have all the yeast available nitrogen that you're going to need to make a healthy, clean fermentation. So finding the right level of nutrient, but not starting at zero, because your fruit is going to add some yeast available nitrogen to your solution.
Gotcha. Okay.
So it's basically the core things of a healthy fermentation, but with the fruit dynamic added.
Gotcha. Okay. And then with a methylgen, do the herbs form some sort of a cap, or is that different kind of?
I would say that the bigger risk with methylglen is over extraction.
Okay.
That because mead has such a low buffer capacity, like we talked about, right? Like mm-hmm. a pinch of salt in the broth can totally change the flavor, whereas a pinch of salt in the stew, you might not even notice it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that analogy translates to mead, because mead is a very low buffer capacity. It's like a thin broth. And so a little change to the broth can change the flavor profile profoundly. So if you add too much herbs or spices to the mead at any one point, it's going to go from being pleasant and aromatic and balanced and interesting to being over the top and abrasive and unilateral in the expression of that herb or spice.
Interesting.
So you really have to have a delicate hand in adding the spices to a methylene, and then understanding where it's going to add too, because if you add the spices in primary, the process of fermentation will kind of potentially, depending on what yeast you're using, consume those components that the herb or spice is contributing, and then translate them through the fermentation profile and basically round them out is typically the rule of thumb. Sometimes they can accentuate it too.
Okay.
So typically the fermentation profile will really soften things, but some things don't get softened at all. So whereas they might've been in harmony prior to the fermentation, now they're out of order because one of the aspects got totally softened and one of them didn't at all. And now that point is way too strong. That latter point that didn't get softened at all is way too strong because the other balancing point isn't there. And so now it's just like intense and overpowering. So what we typically do is add the herbs after fermentation in a very small amount, taste it every day when it's tasting good, basically wait one more day and then pull it, because we know once you pull it, it's going to kind of fall off. But you don't want it to fall off too much and now become unnoticeable.
Gotcha. Okay.
So
your experience with methylene is like post-fermentation adding and just tasting every day till you feel like it tastes good.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. And we have a scaling factor discount too. So if we do a 5-gallon batch, we take that recipe and scale it up, but we multiply the spices by 50% and we pitch those in and then we taste them. And then we can always leave it in longer or add more, but you can't take it out, right?
Yeah. Just because you've had too many experiences where you've added too much and it's overpowering, essentially.
Specifically with lavender.
Okay.
That just too much lavender becomes soapy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And then with braggots, what are the challenges to brewing with grain and honey?
You know, I've never made a braggot.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Oh, okay.
That's too close to beer to me. There's far too many breweries in San Diego. So, not going to do it.
Not going to do it.
Got to talk to other people about that.
Okay. That's fair. Okay, and then with traditional mead, which we're pretty familiar with here, it's just balancing the mead stool in your fermentation, and you don't really have to worry about anything up top like you do with the mill, right?
Right.
Okay. Is there any like specific recipes that are super rare that you want to talk about that you've tasted or you want to make that are interesting to you?
Oh man. Billy Belts at Last Cause and Chris Hare, they did a candy cap mushroom mead.
Candy cap mushroom.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which are like these culinary mushrooms that people are excited about because they have this like caramely butterscotch flavor profile. And they figured out how to make it work. It was intense and flavorful and pretty delicious. So they use a bunch of preservatives in it. And I can't drink too much of that stuff.
No, that's fair.
Yeah. Passion fruit mead, I think, is very promising. I think that those flavor profiles paired with the right honeys can be really good. British people love passion fruit. Scottish people love passion fruit.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, so there's a niche there.
There's a big market in the UK for passion fruit meat?
Maybe. I mean, apparently, like, anything that has passion fruit in it just sells 2 times better than anything that doesn't.
Huh.
Yeah, they love it.
Okay.
Maybe because it's just so tropical. But like here in Southern California where it just grows in our yards, it's like, oh, passion fruit. That's good.
Yeah. It's whatever. I wouldn't think twice about it, honestly.
Right? But like we're spoiled. In the northern latitudes where passion fruit doesn't grow, people are like, oh, it's so aromatic and flavorful and tropical and delicious. I think methylenes are like one of my favorite things to explore, and I hope we get to do more in the near future because they they make me think of like, so the word methylene comes from the old Welsh word for medicine.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So a methylene was a mead made with herbs and spices, and you drank it to get better or to be healthy.
Like that was the intention of the
situation. Yeah, like here, drink this. And like, you know, there's a whole tradition of taking the herbs and spices and making them into a concoction that's going to make people better and make life better for people. So I think that my experiences with methylene are that it's incredibly interesting. You get into the whole realm of plants and human plant interaction, ethnobotany, that whole thing, but you get to do it in this incredibly approachable and easily consumed platform.
Yeah. And it kind of fits into that regenerative loop too, where adding a sort of plant within your ecosystem from the honey that was made from the same ecosystem is something that would be really cool to do, in my opinion.
And yeah, unequaled, right? Like if we use Artemisia californicum, which is an Artemisia, like wormwood, and we use white sage and black sage, like these are medicinal plants for the indigenous people here, but it's a drink that could only be made here. Like those plants don't really grow in other parts of the world.
Yeah.
So we can deliver something that theoretically, and there are studies that show that like white sage smoke has antifungal, antibacterial properties. So what are those benefits, you know, that the native people here understood and that we're just figuring out even scientific methods to understand them, but then to include them in this beverage, which was traditionally a way to carry these medicines. Yeah, I'd love to experiment with more.
And it grows on like bringing people to a certain place.
Exactly.
That you want to transport them there, and adding the plants where the honey grows essentially
enhances
that experience.
Totally. And like the native people use wild buckwheat, right? Like that little pink and white flower that grows, it's finally going out of season, but for the last month and a half, it's been on every highway side in North County, San Diego, right? The native people used to walk with a basket in one hand and a thresher in the other hand, and they just whack these seeds from the wild buckwheat and make this porridge. And like, apparently the people that lived here only had to work like 2 to 3 hours a day or 2 to 3 days a week, and they could feed their families with that little work.
Sounds good to me.
Right? Like, what are we missing out on here?
What's up with this 40 hours?
Yeah, there's 60. So, yeah, could we reconnect people with that? Like, if we did a Western buckwheat honey, sage blossom honey, with Western buckwheat and sage and Artemisia californicum, which is our coastal sage scrub, then made a mead out of that. That would be so epic.
Yeah, we call it the California mead or California, the West Coast mead.
Yeah, man. Chaparral mead.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Getting into the different types of traditional, where there's, you said ABV is a big important part of like session versus show versus sack is what you said.
Right.
Where my head goes with that is the amount of honey going in. But also, from what I understand of yeast, you can stop fermentation short. So is there a play between like how much honey to water ratio that defines those three? Or is it just specifically NABV that defines it?
Yeah, a sweetness versus alcohol. And are those three categories only defined by alcohol, or are they also defined by sweetness?
Yeah, so for example, if I do a super heavy honey to water ratio, so it's
2 to 1.
Sure.
2 parts water, 1 part honey.
Okay, sure.
Okay.
And I have a yeast that ends that at 18%. Is that considered a show mead? And then I take that same honey and I just lessen the ratio and I just use a different yeast and I bring it down below 10. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Is that a session?
Yeah. Or
so 18,
what's the interplay there? Is it specifically just ABV, or is there something else at play there?
Yeah. So ABV is basically your category break.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're over 10%, it's not a session. If you're over 14%, it's not a show. It's a sack. It's not a standard. It's a sack. And then sweetness level can vary within these three breakdowns.
Okay.
So you could have a sweet session, a sweet standard, and then a sweet sack. You can have a off-sweet session, off-sweet standard, off-sweet sack. You can have a off-dry session, off-dry standard, off-dry sack. Gotcha. And then you can have a dry session, a dry standard, and a dry sack.
So within those three, there's, okay.
But there's certain, like a dry sack, unless you've aged it for a long time and it has a lot of other things going on, like that stool is probably going to fall over because the alcohol is too high.
Mm-hmm.
Traditional standards, you know, you can make those work between sweet all the way to dry, but it takes some artistry to make it work. And then in the sessions, kind of same, right? Like too sweet, it's going to fall over. Too dry, it's going to fall over.
Gotcha. Okay, that makes sense to me. So just within each one, there's a variance between dry to sweet, essentially.
Yep.
Okay. That's interesting.
And it's alcohol that really defines those subcategories of the traditionals.
And would you say most people are just doing the 12% ABVs out there, or do you see all of them?
12 is probably the majority, but I feel like there are a lot of 8s out there. Okay. And then there's a lot of 14 to 16s out there, too.
Okay, that's fair. So people are within all of those ranges.
Yeah.
Which is kind of unique-ish to mead, I would say, because like with beer, you're generally within the 5 to 8 to 10.
I mean, I think 10 is even like you're getting high. Yeah, but like 5 to 8, it's like if we're having a craft beer, that's where it's going to be, right? Yeah. If you're having a macro beer, it's like 3.5 to 5.5.
Yeah. And then wines generally are within the 12-ish.
I think in 14. California, we're getting like 14 is the typical, right? Like yeah. 13, 14 is the typical.
Like that's just the standard for those industries. And you don't have like session wines, I guess, or anything like that. Or
yeah, wine sack coolers.
Beers or anything like that.
Right. Or extra strong, like barley wines.
Yeah. Right. So with mead, you can experience kind of the whole realm of ABV content, where with wine and beer, you're kind of like dialed into a certain range, which is interesting.
Yeah, unless you're at a place that like will deliberately offer offerings outside of those ranges.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas mead, it's like, whoa, what are we getting? We could be getting a 5% dry or an 18% super sweet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then everything in between.
Yeah, it's just the range is a lot bigger.
Yeah.
And is there anything else you want to talk about when it comes to labeling? I think my biggest beef is, like you mentioned earlier, the names are just whack.
Yeah, Melomel, Methylglen, these names are not doing us any favors, right? It's like how to confuse people. So one of my friends, Maury Fletcher, who was our first head brewer here, said, we got to get away from those names because no one knows what they mean. How about we just call them fruit meads, spice meads, and honey, I mean, beers, grain meads. Yeah, exactly. Meads with grain in them. But yeah, I think there's a strong case to be made that fruit mead and spiced or herbed mead is better than Melomel and Methylglen.
Yeah.
It's less confusing.
Yeah, and it's just more easily accessible for consumers.
Yeah.
To like get entry understanding of like what the world they're getting into, essentially.
Exactly.
And traditionals, and because I mean how do beer and wine do it? I mean, I guess beer and wine have a lot of different variations styles to it, and I guess that's okay, right?
Yeah, it's, I mean, the history of beer and wine bridges the pre-industrial and industrial revolutionary ages.
Mm-hmm.
So beer was something that like every town made, and based off the agriculture of the place and the climate of the place, there was a certain style, right? Like a lager, a German lager, was made in northern Germany, during the winter because it was cold there, yeah. And the malted barley was available to brew from. And then these lager yeasts lived in the cold temperatures. And so that was the beer that you drank in the winter in Germany. Yeah. And then in the summer, when like the wheat was available and different yeasts lived, you got wit beers and Berliner Weisses, right?
Yeah.
So these were like regional products that became that got named based off of the agriculture and climatic region of the place. Mm-hmm. And like a porter and a stout, like these were all styles that existed in a certain area based off of how they malted and then what yeast were available to ferment them. And then when beer became an international industry, certain beer companies were like, hey, we got to lock this down. And they hired scientists to define what these characteristics were and what these processes were. And then they said, if you do it perfect, you get 100 points. If you deviate from it, you lose points. So that incentivized everyone who made them to shoot for that end state. Mm-hmm. Whereas in mead, it's like, yeah, there were all these traditional things, but like the lens of science hasn't been applied. These standards haven't been created so that you can make a German lager in a tropical environment. Yeah. Now, you know, like those standards of what that honey was and what those characteristics were that made that mead what that mead was, and then how those herbs and spices and fruits were grown that were added to that mead have not been pinned down to the point that they can be reproduced in a different part of the world.
Yeah, and I think the same goes with wine too, where it's more regional and there's a lot of science that goes into it essentially.
Yeah, now, yeah, after, yeah, you know, 70 years of there being an international wine industry.
Yeah, so it's kind of just hard to pin down the honeys the way that those industries have done it essentially.
And the fermentation yeasts and processes. Like there's a case to be made that mead was made once a year and then it was left to age over the course of a whole year. And some people have evidence of Vikings throwing whole beehives into a pot. So like, how did you harvest your honey? You threw the whole hive into the pot. Yeah, it's a pretty Viking way to do it. And so the wax melts, right, in the pot, and then that pot cools, and then the wax becomes this layer, this like cap on top of the pot. And there's bee bodies in there, and there's pollen, and there's propolis, and there's whatever other things. And they're all fermenting, and at different parts of the fermentation, different organisms have prevalence over each other. So the meads that they were drinking might have been a symbiotic fermentation of yeast, bacteria, and other organisms.
Hmm. That's super interesting. Has anyone ever tried to replicate that?
Yeah, this crazy guy named Michael Jordan.
Like the basketball player?
Yeah, this guy Michael Jordan wants to come here and make a batch with us. He's really brilliant. He's also wild. He's like an abbot and he marries people. Had like an underground meadery for a number of years. I don't know what the status of it is legally, but apparently he has done that where he's taken beehives and thrown them in the pot. And, you know, he doesn't do it often, or I don't even know how many times he's done it, but he's like, dude, it's a different experience because you got the bee venom in there.
Yeah.
Which my experience with the wasp venom from last episode, it's like, yeah, bee venom is similarly potent but less intense. But if you have a whole hive's worth of bees venom in your mead, maybe that's similarly euphoric. I don't know. So that was one style of mead, but no one wrote down those processes and pinned it down and turned it into a, you know, American Society of
Pretty
Brewing
simple.
Chemists. Yeah.
Chop down hives, throw them in a pot.
Well, but is it the linden honey or is it the heather honey? You know, like Vikings are in both areas.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Okay. That's super cool. Anything else?
Shoot, man. I can talk about this stuff all day. I mean, I think if we look at the historical record, there's some really cool stories about mead that go way, way back in Central and Southern and Northern South America. The Mayans and I think the Aztecs too, and I'm not entirely sure over whose dynasties existed where and when exactly, but I know in the Yucatan Peninsula and beyond, there is archaeological and cultural evidence of a fermented drink from the stingless honeybee, the Melipona, which is a social bee that doesn't have a stinger, and they collect nectar and store it in these little wax pots that their hives are made out of.
Okay.
The indigenous people were collecting this, they were mixing with water, and they were fermenting it in the trunk of a tree called the Balche tree. And so this would be like a traditional, but maybe a mesalamine if like the vessel is extracting aspects of the tree trunk.
Yeah, okay. Right?
And it was a ceremonial beverage, and the gods were coming down.
Was it like an open fermentation?
I believe they covered it with leaves.
Oh, okay.
Interesting. Yeah. And so the gods would come down to the party when they drank the Balche, and good things would happen. So that was one aspect of the history of traditional mead that I think is really interesting. There's also cassavir, which Dr. Patrick McGovern found dust on a drinking vessel at a burial site in Scandinavia near Oslo. And they, Scandinavia, just in Norway, near Oslo. And they came up with this recipe that we're going to try with birch syrup, lingonberries, and bog myrtle. And so bog myrtle is a bittering herb that was medicinal. So, and then honey. So we're going to make this mead with those ingredients and see how it tastes and hopefully have something awesome to share with the people.
And that'd be mainly a methylagen, right?
I mean, it's a super beverage is what Dr. McGovern calls them, because it was like fruit, right? The lingonberries.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Herbs and honey. It was probably also made with grain in different places. And then there are cases where these super beverages were made with grain, honey, and grapes. So it's kind of like beer, wine, mead, yeah. all synergized together.
Does that exist currently where like someone just purposefully, that's their thing, they just brew all three together?
So I haven't seen anyone do all three explicitly or exclusively, but Dogfish Head has had a series of beers that are rediscovering these ancient super beverages. So Jihu was one, and that was using rice, grapes, muscat grapes, which grew in the Chinese Jihu River Valley, and honey. Midas is another beverage that they did, which is from the dust of a drinking vessel at the king, the tomb of the king who is supposedly Midas, King Midas. And it has honey and I think sorghum and some kind of grape and saffron and a few other ingredients.
That's super interesting. But yeah, you probably have to be a brewery
to handle the grain
in the U.S. to experiment with all of that, because like someone like us can't do the grain.
Correct. Wineries aren't allowed to have grain on their property. You can do an alternating proprietorship where you literally paint a line down the middle of your production facility and say, this is a brewery, this is a winery. Really? And the grain can't come over to the winery. And you have to keep two sets of books.
What? Well, never mind. That's a different podcast. That's interesting.
Yeah. Okay. But I think it's fair to hypothesize that some of our ancestors were only using honey to make these beverages. And so if we
adapt. Why do you think it's fair when a lot of the ancient recipes seem to have all three?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. Because there are written testaments throughout time of just honey-based beverages.
Gotcha.
But it's like that wasn't available enough. Honey was too special, so they kind of had to like up the sugar bill with other sugar providing foods.
Gotcha. So a honey-based beverage was probably just more rare and it wasn't year-round.
Yes.
And the more year-round beverages might have had a little bit of honey in them, but it also had grain, the grapes, fruit, the grain. Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. But the real honey beverages were saved for major parties.
And for the wealthiest people that could afford them.
Gotcha. Okay. That makes sense. Well, thanks for doing a deep dive on the different categories.
My pleasure, man. That was fun.
And if you guys have anything interesting that you want to try or that you've heard of, let us know.
Yeah. Call us, leave us your first name, where you're calling from, city and state or country, and what kind of mead makes you the most excited, what kind of mead you'd love to try to make, what kind of mead you'd love to see us try and make. Who knows, maybe we'll do it and then we'll send you a bottle. Yeah. And we'll get your tasting notes and we'll share that with the audience after we share your inspiration.
That'd be pretty fun, actually.
That would be super fun. All right, cheers. Yeah.
All right, that's a wrap on all the different kinds of mead out there. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us. We appreciate all the support we can get. If there's anything you'd like to know more about, feel free to email us at podcast@goldencoastmead.com with your questions, and we'll try to answer them to the best of our ability for you. Now, here's your weekly bee joke. If you have a bee in your hand, what do you have in your eye? Beauty, because beauty is in the eye of the bee holder. Mead out.